I'm Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, the costs of health care and disability benefits for U.S. soldiers who have served in Iraq and Afghanistan. But first, as the U.S. military prepares to send more troops to Iraq, there are questions about whether soldiers who have been deemed medically unfit are going back to Iraq anyway. That's what Salon journalist Mark Benjamin found out when speaking with five soldiers at Fort Benning, Georgia recently. The soldiers from the 3rd Infantry Division say Army doctors recently reevaluated their medical status and decided they are fit to be redeployed. Some have already shipped out to Iraq. Others are fighting their deployment orders. The military says that any previously injured soldiers going back to Iraq will be kept out of harm's way. Well, Mark Benjamin joins us now from Washington. And Mark, what were these soldiers at Fort Benning telling you?
What they were saying is that they have serious injuries and ailments. You know, for example, people with spine injuries who, you know, their spine is in such bad shape, you know, whether it's from a previous tour in Iraq or from training, you know, training accident. Let's say their spine is so injured that they can't wear their body armor. That's an example. Perhaps it's extreme, but I certainly found several people like that down at Fort Benning who are now being sent back to Iraq.
Yeah. And there was one woman soldier that you spoke with who had severe injuries, and she did go back to Iraq.
That's right. She's already gone. I interviewed her in the very next day. Last week, I interviewed her, and the very next day, she was deployed to Iraq. And she is actually a perfect example of somebody with a spine injury. She actually had her coccyx bone removed and has some lower back problems that are very serious. She cannot wear her body armor, and she's there now. She's in Kuwait and getting ready to go north. I also interviewed her husband, a man who is an infantry soldier, has already done 3 combat tours, 1 in Afghanistan, 2 in Iraq, and he is very, very concerned about his wife being over there in this particular situation. I would add, just to put a twist on this story, last month, on February 15th, 2 doctors, the division surgeon and the battalion surgeon, brought 75 of these soldiers with various health problems in for a series of what the soldiers describe as cursory meetings to discuss their what's called physical profile, which would be a piece of paper that shows how sick you are and whether or not you can go to war. The soldiers allege, some of these soldiers are alleging, that their physical profiles were updated to make them look much healthier than they were before, so that they could be deployed to Iraq. And that happened last month on February 15th.
Now, these soldiers that you spoke with, one of them is a master sergeant who does identify himself. Were most of them forthcoming with this information?
Well, most of them were very forthcoming with the information and were eager, I would say, almost desperate to meet and to share their medical records and to share the pieces of paper that show, you know, physical profiles from before February 15th that show them as, frankly, very damaged goods and after February 15th looking that much better. A lot of them were, because they wanted this to stop and they thought that, you know, basically a news article might get force the command to stop doing this, but many of them were very afraid to have their names in my article. The two that came forward, one, frankly, just felt so concerned about the situation, and I felt like I needed some people on the record that he was willing to do it. Another who's on the record in my article, frankly, I think he just sort of feels like he has nothing left to lose. He thinks that if he's deployed, he's in big, big trouble.
Mm-hmm. Now, you did speak with some of the military officials and some of the folks involved with this February 15th review of the soldiers. So what are they telling you?
The military says two things. First of all, I did interview the battalion commander, and his point was, look, you know, as the battalion commander, we often send people to overseas who have these things called physical profiles, which is when you have some sort of problem that will limit your duties. What the argument from the military is we are going to send some of these people to Iraq, it's true, but we're going to put them in jobs where they're not in harm's way. They'll be working at the PX at the grocery store or sitting behind a desk shuffling paper. The problem is that the soldiers, many of whom have been to Iraq before, think it just sort of doesn't work out like that in Iraq. At some point or another, you're going to be in a job where you're going to be in harm's way and you're going to need to wear that body armor, and you shouldn't be shipped overseas if you can't. With respect to what happened on February 15th, the Army admits that the division surgeon, who I did interview, and the battalion surgeon, this is of the 3rd Brigade, I'm sorry, the brigade surgeon, do admit that on February 15th, they did bring 75 of these people with these health problems to a meeting at the troop clinic. Now, what happened that day is in dispute. The soldiers I interviewed, and I interviewed 8 soldiers separately who all said the same thing, who were there that day, that they walked into a room and the division surgeon and the brigade surgeon gave a very cursory discussion of their health problems, and they walk out. Next thing you know, they've got orders to go to Iraq. some of those people.
Briefly, Mark. Briefly, we're almost out of time. 10 seconds.
Well, essentially, the surgeon is saying that this is, that they did everything right that day. The soldier is saying, no, you didn't, you know, do a good job of taking care of my health and figuring out whether I can go overseas.
All right. Mark Benjamin is a writer for the online magazine Salon. For a link to his article, go to our website, here-now.org. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks for having me.
Among those examining veterans' health care issues is Congress, and tomorrow hearings are scheduled on Capitol Hill about disability benefits for veterans wounded in Iraq and Afghanistan. Linda Bilmes will be testifying tomorrow. She's a lecturer at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University and a former Assistant Commerce Department Secretary. She says right now there are more than 500,000 vets waiting for their disability benefits to be processed, and sometimes it takes as long as 2 years before an injured veteran receives a check. Professor Bilmes joins us to talk about this, and we should start by mentioning that when we spoke with you earlier this year, we talked about a study you did then, which estimated that the overall cost of the Iraq War was at $2 trillion. Now you say that number's up to $2.5 trillion, but how do veterans' health care expenses fit into that overall cost?
Interestingly, after we did our study, even though the number $2 trillion was a high number, all of the veterans groups, a very wide range of veterans groups from around the country, contacted me and said, thank you for shining a spotlight on the veterans issue, but actually your numbers are too low. And over the last 6 months, I worked with a number of veterans organizations and veterans advocates to secure data from the Veterans Administration and the Defense Department so I could really understand what the capacity was of the VA to take care of veterans and how much it would cost. Depending on how fast the veterans come back and what level of disability claims they are granted, the cost of taking care of veterans is somewhere between $300 and $650 billion in addition to the other war costs.
House Democratic leadership recently released its Iraq war bill that includes funding for a lot of different things regarding the war in Iraq. The measure includes, I think, $3.5 billion more than the White House requested for veterans' health care. Do you think that will make a difference? From some of these numbers, it sounds like it's barely a drop in the bucket.
There are more than 200,000 soldiers who have come home and who have sought medical care from the Veterans Administration already. Of those, more than a third, about 36%, have sought care for various mental health conditions, including PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, substance abuse, acute depression, and other type of mental health problems. So, you know, the issue on the healthcare side is really about how much capacity we have to provide particularly mental health care to a large volume of returning veterans. And in a way, the faster that the war comes to a conclusion, the higher number we need, because everyone is going to come home at once, which is going to completely overwhelm the facilities at the VA. And that's what's already happening, and most of them have not come home. So in terms of whether the $3 billion is the right number, in terms of processing disability claims, it's not a matter of money. It's a matter of completely changing the way we process benefits.
How would we change it?
Right now what happens is a veteran comes back from the war and they have to file a benefits claim, which is a very complicated process. It then gets entered into the benefit system. It then goes into a claims adjudication process in one of 57 different VA claims adjudicating centers with very different levels of speed. And they then have to go through a process of proving that they were, in fact, veterans, that all of the things that they're claiming for are accurate, and then there finally is a decision made. Now, that process takes a minimum of 6 months. It varies a lot from center to center. In some centers, it's taking up to 2 years. So what I have suggested is that they essentially scrap that system, at least until they can redesign it, and accept all the claims on face value, like the IRS does with taxes, and then audit them afterwards. So that way, a returning veteran, instead of being tied up in a 2-year paperwork fight, can begin receiving what is essentially a small amount of money so they can get going again. And if there's an adjustment to be made, it can be made later on. I think this works better because 90% of these claims are granted anyway.
What will be the focus of your testimony? Will it be change the procedure for disability benefits and giving your estimate of what these long-term costs are?
Right now, there is a backlog of 500,000 or 600,000 pending claims that are sitting around. Now, what does that mean? That means that somebody who has been through the war for, in many cases, 2 years of deployment, who comes back with a major disability of one kind or another, perhaps they're deaf in an ear, or they have major neuromuscular problems, or PTSD, or some other ailment that really impairs their ability to get going, has to wait for a year or 2 years to get what is essentially a few hundred dollars a month to help them out as they get back on their feet. And the time when they need that money the most is when they first come home. What they don't need is for them and their families to have to fight a bureaucracy for 2 years.
You know, when you hear what you're saying about this bureaucracy and about the backlog of cases and how difficult it's going to be to deal with that, and we've obviously heard the very high-profile comments about the Walter Reed Army Medical Center and the problems there. Do you look at the whole system and say, this is really a broken system, the way we're taking care of our veterans?
Well, what you have is a complete lack of planning for the veterans when they come home, which is similar to the lack of planning that went into the war in the first place. We didn't plan for a prolonged occupation, and we also have not planned for what happens after the occupation when many hundreds of thousands of veterans return. So what you have within the Veterans Administration are many people who sincerely want to help veterans, fantastic doctors, claims processors, and other people, but it is a very slow, old-fashioned, cumbersome bureaucratic system which was creaking along even before this war, and it simply cannot respond quickly enough to a huge volume, a huge surge in claims to be able to be of any help to the current veterans.
What would help, do you think? Would maybe more of a privatizing the system, would that help? Or how is it fixable?
I think they ought to explore some kind of vouchers so the veterans can go to any medical provider outside of the VA and receive free medical care. I think the government should reimburse anyone getting care from any facility, for example, if they can't get an appointment. And if somebody comes back with PTSD, they can't wait. I mean, they can't wait 30 days to get an appointment in order to be seen by a triage nurse who's then going to assign them to a specialist eventually. They have to be seen right away.
Linda Bilmes, a lecturer at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University, who will be testifying before Congress about veterans' health care and disability benefits. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Deb.
And just ahead, the art of negotiation. A professional negotiator says sometimes a firm no is needed. And later in the show, the missteps of Massachusetts' new governor, Deval Patrick. You're listening to Here and Now. How do you say no and stay positive about it? Well, professional negotiator William Urey says we could all use a little help saying no, which he claims is nothing more than a different way of saying yes. William Urey is director of Harvard University's Global Negotiation Project and co-author of the book Getting to Yes. His new book is The Power of a Positive No, How to Say No and Still Get to Yes. And William Urey, after so many years of focusing on yes, why are you now writing about saying no?
No is maybe today's greatest challenge. Thanks to the information revolution, we're all overwhelmed with information, with choices, with demands. Life is speeding up. And in order to say yes to those things which are truly important to us, we need to learn to say no in order to slow down a little bit.
Being the mother of teenagers, and you're the father of teenagers, oftentimes we have to say no. And we probably feel like we sound like our parents when we say to our children, what part of no don't you understand? Wasn't no sort of the non-negotiable here? No means no?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. When I ask adults, you know, what's the worst no you've ever received in your life? The majority of them say, it was the one I heard from my parents. It was no. Why? Because I told you so. That's why.
Right.
In other words, it's a purely negative no. It's power dominated. It's just there's no explanation. There's no respect. And the key thing about a positive no is that it's not rejecting. It's actually respectful of the other as you say no, as you draw a line.
So what are some pointers here about how to say no positively?
Well, when we want to say no, we often fall into what I call the 3A trap. We accommodate. In other words, we say yes when we mean to say no. We give in, which is not satisfying to us for sure. Or we do the opposite. We attack. We're very aggressive in our no's. You know, I told you so, that's why. And or we avoid. We don't say anything at all. We need to say no positively in order to defend what's right. And a positive no, as you mentioned, begins with a yes. For example, talking to your boss is asking you to work through the weekend. You start with your yes. What are you saying yes to when you want to say no? I have an important family commitment this weekend. Then you are very matter-of-fact, respectful in your no, no edge, just, you know, so I can't work this weekend. And then you immediately followed up with another yes, and I can work late Wednesday night, Thursday night, we can bring in John and Mary and we can get the work done. In other words, it's a no that's preceded by a yes, and it ends in a yes. That's what makes it positive.
So is it no as part of the art of compromise?
It can be. It's not about compromising your central interest, because no is about defending your central interest, not just a no that ends in a no. It's a no that ends with a possible exploration, maybe a negotiation for a mutually satisfactory agreement.
Have you used this in your negotiating, say, with rebels in the Russian breakaway Republic of Chechnya, or, you know, with the striking workers in Kentucky? Or when have you found that this approach has really been effective in first a formal sense and then maybe something that's not quite so formal and more personal?
Absolutely. This is kind of born out of 25 or 30 years of experience in difficult negotiations. You mentioned Chechnya, where I was asked to facilitate a meeting between the top Russian leaders and the top Chechen leaders. And I remember being kind of vociferously attacked by the vice president of Chechnya, who said, an American, and you Americans, you're on the side of the Russians, and he went on to attack, and look at what you're doing in Puerto Rico. And meanwhile, I was kind of thinking, what do I know about Puerto Rico? What are we doing in Puerto Rico? But, I was getting distracted. And The key thing when you're going to say, when you're negotiating, is to remain focused on what you want to achieve. So I was able to go to a mental balcony to kind of to step back and say, okay, no. What am I trying to do here? Am I really in this to get into an argument with the vice president of Chechnya, or are we trying to settle a problem? And so in that time, I was able to think that through. And so I thanked him for his remarks and said, I take your candor, you know, as a sign that we're among friends and we can speak frankly to each other. And what we're here to do is not to talk about Puerto Rico or even the United States. We're here to see if we can stop a civil war here in Chechnya, to get the conversation back on track. So in a positive way, I was saying no to the argument or to the criticism, to be able to focus on what was important there, and so the conversation got back on track.
What if you're in a situation where you really have difficulty with the person you're negotiating with, and there just seems to be a standoff, and taking some of the principles that you're talking about in terms of letting the other person know that you value them and respect, if those things are difficult to achieve in a situation, what does somebody do?
Yeah, I think the first thing, as I mentioned, is to kind of go to the balcony. You may take some time out if it's an emotionally charged situation, and often these situations are where there's a lot of fear and there's a lot of anger. Fear leads you to give in. Anger leads you to go on the attack, neither of which are productive reactions. So the first thing to do is buy some time. Take a time out. Take a break. If it's, ask someone if you can call them back. And then do whatever you need to do to bring yourself back into a calm state of mind so you can focus on what's truly important to you and realize that, you know, it may have nothing to do with them, whether you can keep your eyes on the yes, the greater yes for which you are saying no.
How would you recommend that people sort of at least start thinking about it, maybe practice saying no positively?
We're all saying no every single day, or we'd like to. I mean, almost every single hour. Life, in fact, is a dance of yes and no. And so it's more like a muscle that you need to develop with some practice. And the reason why I've tried to kind of take what is really common sense in some sense, but it's uncommonly practiced, and put it into a very simple format of beginning with a yes, then following through with a very matter-of-fact, respectful no, and then following up with a yes, is to enable us to keep on practicing it. And with that practice, we can get much better at it. And the key thing I find particularly with teenagers is respect. I once had a Marine Corps general in one of my classes at Harvard and come all the way from Japan to take this course on negotiation. At the end of the 2 days, he says, you know, the thing I got most out of this course was this emphasis on respect. I finally appreciated why I'm having so much trouble with my 16-year-old son is I'm not giving him the respect that he deserves.
Right, right. So that's the key.
You know, we demand respect from our kids, but are we really giving it to them? You know, you can't ask for something that you're not willing to give the other.
William Urey is director of Harvard University's Global Negotiation Project and author of the book, The Power of a Positive No, How to Say No and Still Get to Yes. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. The newly elected governor here in Massachusetts, Deval Patrick, made a surprising announcement over the weekend. He said he's going to work less. Patrick said he needs to spend more time with his wife, 55-year-old Diane Patrick, who is suffering from exhaustion and depression. His announcement comes after a series of missteps and public mea culpas from a political newcomer who's been in office only 9 weeks. Patrick is just the second African-American elected governor in U.S. history, and he was considered an up-and-coming national political figure. For more on this story, we turn to Boston Globe political reporter Frank Phillips. Thanks for being with us.
It's great to be with you.
Today, Governor Deval Patrick is highlighting an education initiative, so he is working. What exactly does it mean that he'll work a more flexible schedule?
I think exactly that. He'll make appearances, but I don't think you'll see him going out at night or on weekends and taking just more time to be with his wife, as he should be.
You know, he ran a strong grassroots political campaign. He was virtually unknown when he first started. But his first few weeks in office have been very bumpy. Can you remind us of what's happened these past few weeks?
Sure. He made some mistakes that were more symbolic than substantive at first. He switched the governor's car from a Ford LTD to a Cadillac for twice the lease, and that didn't play well at all, and he had to defend it and ended up paying the difference in the lease. He also had spent about $27,000 on new drapes and furniture and lamps in the office, and he agreed that, well, he will pay that out of his own personal funds. I think most people accepted that. He did his mea culpas. Last week, we published a story, I think, which was a lot more serious and got him into a jam, in which he had made a call to Citigroup and to Bob Rubin, one of the top executives, the former U.S. Treasury Secretary, on behalf of Patrick was calling on behalf of a very controversial mortgage company, which he had had a relationship with and sat on the board of until last July, AmeriQuest, and he was asking that Citigroup help finance this troubled company. He did it as governor, and a lot of people questioned his judgment.
So there may be now an ethics investigation into that phone call.
He may very well, and people do expect an ethics review of it. Coming on top of the other two things also, it raises, you know, questions about whether he really has the experienced staff or even the experience himself to understand what to do in certain situations as governor.
You know, there was so much enthusiasm and a lot of talk about perhaps another Massachusetts governor making a national foray into national politics. Has that changed now because of these missteps, do you think?
I think it's early to draw that conclusion. I think he still has time to put things together. There's a lot of goodwill and good feelings towards him. He communicates very well. He's a sympathetic character. His missteps have drawn down the goodwill that is in the bank account. People are getting, and particularly his supporters, are getting very nervous about it and looking for him to maybe make some staff additions that people could tell him, don't take this call from AmeriQuest, don't rent a Cadillac, don't put up furniture and drapes in your office.
Do you think he's learned from these missteps?
I don't know, and we're all waiting to see. But he needs people who have experience guiding him through this landmine of Massachusetts politics. It's just destroyed the political figures in the past. I think he wanted to change everything here in politics and do it differently, and I think he's learning that there is a system. It has worked for 220 years here in Massachusetts, and he's got to sort of fit into it, and I think he needs a couple of Sherpa guides to show him how to do it.
All right. Well, Frank Phillips, veteran Boston Globe political reporter, thanks very much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome, Deborah.
Well, Deval Patrick was a former top U.S. civil rights lawyer in the Clinton administration, and during his campaign, he received a great deal of national attention. For more about how his recent political stumbles are playing out on the national stage, we turn to Boston University history professor and political analyst Julian Zelizer. Welcome, Julian.
Thanks for having me.
Julian, first of all, what's your reaction to Deval Patrick saying that he'll be working less because of his wife's treatment for exhaustion and depression?
I think for many people it's understandable in terms of trying to balance what he's going through personally with his job, but I think politically it's a difficult statement for many people to hear. I mean, many people consider the governorship, any executive position, a full-time job, and even with great personal difficulty, they expect the person to be in office, you know, all week long.
So we may understand, but we have high expectations.
Exactly, yeah.
And how was he received, remind us, on the national stage?
Well, look, he came into office, he ran for office and came into office with high expectations on two fronts. First, he promised to be a fresh voice in the Massachusetts political system, in some ways generational change as much as partisan change. And second, obviously, as an African-American governor, many people in the media followed his career and followed this election. So many people were watching closely to see how he would be as a leader and if he would bring the kind of freshness that he promised.
So how will these incidents that have happened in his 9 weeks in office affect things for him on a national stage?
I think it's going to cause difficulties. It already has. I mean, his first weeks in office have been consumed with everything from ethics charges to his own personal problems and troubles, two questions about his leadership. And what the governor needs is for people to be focused on what he's doing as governor rather than these other kinds of issues. So I think in terms of the national stage, it's already stolen some of the spotlight in terms of his successes and focused more on his problems. He still can overcome this. You know, politicians are very resilient. But I think it's caused some problems.
Is there another political figure to whom you would compare Patrick?
Well, the negative, you know, examples would be Michael Dukakis. His wife's depression became an issue in the 1988 presidential campaign. I don't think he ever fully knew how to respond to those kind of attacks. But to look to more successful, obviously, Patrick's former boss, Bill Clinton, was the master of overcoming all sorts of problems, investigations, and knew ultimately how to refocus attention on what he could do as president. And I think Patrick has to follow that model to refocus attention on what he can do as governor.
And, maybe that's where the mea culpas have come in from Governor Deval Patrick. He has apologized for some of these missteps. Has that worked for him, or has it backfired?
So far, I don't think it's really worked. You know, the statements he's given, I don't think, have ended the stories. I mean, that's the ultimate sign of success in the political arena. So right now, I think, in addition to an apology, he really just needs to do something dramatic in terms of policy. That's really the only way to shift attention.
Well, Julian Zelizer, Boston University history professor and political analyst, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Later in the show, boys will be boys, but that doesn't mean they shouldn't read a good book now and then. We'll have some tips about how to get them to do just that. You're listening to Here and Now. William Carlos Williams was not just a renowned literary figure, he was also a practicing physician in New Jersey. And back in 1921, he diagnosed an 11-year-old with leukemia. He wrote a poem about her impending death called About a Little Girl. Well, it turns out that Williams' diagnosis was wrong. That 11-year-old, Marion Macy, lived to be 91. But for years, that poem Williams wrote about her hung on a wall in the hallway of her home in Missouri, unbeknownst to the world until now. Her sons, Michael and Carl Lund, are fulfilling their mother's wish to share the priceless document with the world, and today the 38-line typewritten poem will be officially published by Southeast Missouri State University, where Michael Lund joins us now by telephone. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you.
Well, what is this poem about? Can you tell? I know you can't read it because it's officially being released later today, but can you say what it's about?
Yes, it is about the girl whom the speaker in the poem, which we believe to be William Carlos Williams himself, reading this medical test that says she will not live. And William Carlos Williams was not just the family doctor, but to some extent a friend of the family. So I think he is moved to think of her not continuing with the family activities that he knows about. For instance, in the poem, the family is going to a lake for summer vacation, and he imagines her going, but in some sense, the journey will be farther than that. And so it's contrasting the images of a child at play and then a child becoming, in a sense, an angel.
And where was this poem all this time, and what does it look like?
Well, it appears to be on a piece of paper that was folded a number of times, not just into a threefold for a letter, but maybe again so that it could go in a pocket or something. And it was, the first I knew of it, in a frame, hanging in the hall in my parents' house. And my belief is, my mother, who liked to do things with her hands, at some point unfolded it and put it in a frame and hung it on the wall.
So is it still in that frame that it was hanging in the hallway in? And what does it look like?
It is in that frame, and, you know, it has yellowed some with age. You can see the creases where the folds are. It's a typewritten manuscript, and it has his handwritten initials down at the bottom, WCW.
So were you walking by this all the time when you were growing up and you didn't know what it was?
I think that's exactly right. even if I knew it was a poem, I might have known that much. I didn't fully understand who William Carlos Williams was and the nature of this poem's place in literary history.
And we understand that the poem has a typo in it?
There is a misspelling of the word balloon.
Is it one L?
One O.
One O.
Yeah. And actually, my mother's name, which is Marion, M-A-R-I-A-N, is spelled M-A-R-I-O-N.
So do you know why it was this poem was never published, or he never wrote it at any other time or anything?
It's more family speculation, but I think the notion was this was a very terrible time for the family to think that they were going to lose a child. And I think that the poem was written before the diagnosis was reversed and given to my grandmother. And later, when it turned out that the occasion of the poem, in a sense, was not a real thing, then the poem was just kind of tucked away. And I think Williams, in his own career, was going to get a lot of attention very soon that pulled him away from that poem. And I would think he might not want, I mean, he was a doctor, to sort of take advantage of a family potential tragedy. And so I think he had no interest, and I guess my grandmother kept it. I don't know when she gave it to my mother.
Well, Michael Lund teaches English at Longwood University in Virginia. He's donating a previously unpublished poem that William Carlos Williams wrote about his mother to Southeast Missouri State University today. Michael, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
A recent Boston Globe article caught our eye. It described a new effort to try to get more boys to read nonfiction. There are some statistics that say adolescent boys read less than any other demographic. But according to former children's librarian, author, and reading advocate Michael Sullivan, boys begin to drop reading much earlier than that, many before the age of 10. We decided to ask Mike Sullivan about this, and he joins us on the line from New Hampshire. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Deborah.
You've said that boys start running into trouble with reading when really they're about only 7 or 8 years old. Why is that?
Well, there's an important shift in their education at that point. They go from being sort of passive acceptors of readers, where we read to them and they're reading as part of a group, to the point where they are independent readers. They're expected to sit down and do reading on their own, and that's where a lot of them back off from reading.
And why is that? Why is it a problem for them to become independent readers, do you think?
Well, one of the problems is that there's a brain lag between boys and girls. The girls' brains just develop a little bit faster than boys. We expect all children to learn to read at basically the same rate. For those that fall behind, there's an awful lot of pressure, there's an awful lot of tension, there's even some shame. They are forced at that point to either admit that this is something that they can't do and that they need help for, or turn to the idea that this just isn't something for them. And that's usually the easier course.
Mm-hmm. So we're expecting too much of boys here.
Yeah, we're expecting them to meet a standard that isn't necessarily fair or realistic. If we allow kids to learn to read at their own level and gave them a lot of choice and freedom in that, a lot of this probably wouldn't be a problem. Eventually, of course, boys' brains do catch up to girls' brains, but that's really not until they're 14.
Hmm. Well, what do you say, though, to folks who are listening and thinking, you know, that's a stereotype. Girls are more verbal and they want to read more and boys take a little longer. What would your response be to that?
When I started in education many, many decades ago, that was very much the belief. But now we have actually an awful lot of brain research that tells us that that isn't true. And Michael Gurian, who wrote a book called Boys and Girls Learn Differently, really deserves a lot of credit for this. He put together an awful lot of the brain research that was out there and made a convincing argument that boys and girls' brains really are structured a little differently and they grow a little differently. Not better, not worse. They just have their own pace.
Hmm. So if we allow for learning differences and things, what would we do to try to make reading more attractive to boys?
The first and foremost is you have to keep reading to kids. We stop reading to kids when they turn 7 because we expect them now to become independent readers. An awful lot of parents and teachers say, well, no, I'm not going to read to you now. Why don't you read to me? And for a boy who's struggling to learn how to read, you have to realize that's punishment. You don't want to punish kids for learning how to read. So we need to keep reading to them. And there's some exciting studies that show that listening to a story being read to you is actually about as good for your language attainment as reading the story yourself. My general idea is you can stop reading to kids when they turn 90 and they can't hear you anymore. Up until then, just keep doing it.
But many of them may not want to when they get to be close to adolescence.
It is a funny thing that a lot of kids feel like that's kind of babyish. On the other hand, when you do start reading to them, they generally change their mind. I read to kids right through high school. And I get all the jokes and I get all the snickering, oh, you're going to read to us, sure. But that usually lasts about 30 seconds. Hmm. And then once the story starts, they get into it.
So what kind of books then would you recommend? And would you recommend saying, even if you may not think it's the most literary, even if it's Captain Underpants, let them read it?
You hit the first one right on the head there, Dav Pilkey, actually. And the funny thing is, this comes up a lot when I go and talk to teachers and librarians. People get the idea that I say, well, let kids read anything, even if it's terrible. That's really not my message. What I'm out there trying to say is, if boys find value in something, then there is value there, even if you don't recognize it. Your job is to go out and find the value. And boy, there's plenty out there. Humor, Dav Pilkey, you mentioned, is one of the biggest approaches, especially for boys that are having trouble reading. Dav Pilkey, John Sheska is sort of the dean of this kind of writing. He writes the Time Warp Trio. Action Adventure is huge. And Gordon Corman, if you want one name to give to a kid, if you've got a kid anywhere from the age of 7 to the age of 19 that's having trouble reading and doesn't like what he's being given, Gordon Corman's the answer. don't be afraid of, you know, heavy-duty sports books. Mike Lupica right now is writing fantastic stuff, and every boy knows Mike Lupica. They've seen him on the Sports Reporters. He's a huge, huge fan. I think he writes great, real, live-action sports. One more that drives parents and teachers crazy, and that's gothic horror. And if you get a 10, 11, 12-year-old boy out there who really desperately wants to read Stephen King, he needs to be reading a man named Darren Shan. He's an English writer, wrote the Cirque de Freak series and the Demonata. And yes, it's a little bloody and it's a little out there, but it's the kind of thing that if you've got a boy who loves to go to horror films, here's the same idea, except for they're not sitting there passively watching a screen. They're involved with the language. So that's a much better approach.
Hmm. What about, though, sort of some of the classics and literature and things? Should we just put that off until they're well into high school? Or?
Well, I mean, you should give it as a choice. There are certainly some classics that have some boy appeal, but an awful lot of what we think of as really great boy literature, when you put it in the hands of a boy these days, it just looks old and dusty. Johnny Tremaine is the great example of that. Just about every school in America still teaches Johnny Tremaine and thinks of it as a very boy-friendly book because it's about war. What it is a very old book that is a little stilted, and for a lot of boys, it's just the kind of reading that they don't want to do.
Hmm. When you talk to people about this, you've done a lot of workshops about reading for boys. Why only boys? I mean, a lot of these books may be stilted for girls as well and can turn them off, yes?
Absolutely, and that's one of the things. If you have a girl who's having trouble reading, who's resisting books and who would much rather be active rather than sit down and read, you probably have a girl who is going to respond to the things that I talk about just like any boy would. And then you'll have some boys, of course, that will be more literate and already be engaged in books, and at which point you don't want to tinker with them. You don't want to change anything. If you got a boy that's reading, leave him alone and let him go.
Mm-hmm. So what would you recommend, what other steps would you recommend that the parents and adults in boys' lives do? What, they keep reading to them, they find books of interest. What are some of the, do you have any other recommendations for folks who are having a hard time getting a young boy to sit down and read?
Yeah, I've got a couple, and the first is relax. Don't go overboard. Pressure isn't going to help. The other thing is to realize that boys tend to see reading as something that's feminized, that is solitary and sedentary, and then something that takes an awful long time. And those are things that boys aren't going to react as well to. There's no reason to make reading like that. Reading can be active and fun and taken in short doses and done as a group. Nonfiction leads towards all of those things. A lot of boys desperately want to read nonfiction, and everyone tells them they're supposed to read fiction. Well, if they read nonfiction, they might find out about things that they can then do. And a lot of boys would like to read for 15 minutes and then go do something about it. The other thing, of course, is role modeling. The men out there have to understand that boys see reading as something that women do. And part of the reason in that is that men tend to read in isolation. It's something that they do, but it doesn't help the boys in their lives. They need to see men read. So men out there, read with kids, read in front of kids, talk to kids about what they're reading and share what they're reading.
Hmm. Michael Sullivan, former librarian and author of the book Connecting Boys with Books, What Libraries Can Do. Michael, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.